So I'm having a little interference. And now I'm making sure I'm recording. Yes. Thank you for your patience. Over the past 6 days, we have been traveling, visiting various persons in their huts from the 7th century through medieval China and Japan to the turn of the 19th century with Ryokan in Japan and Henry David Thoreau in Concord, Massachusetts. And today we're going to move into the 20th century with the great monk, poet, writer, activist, Thomas Merton, who was actually a contemporary of Homeless Kodo, who Michael talked about last night. They died within a year of each other, 1967, 1968, I think. Although Homeless Kodo was much older. So, Sawaki Kodo Roshi. So before I continue, though, you may have noticed that they're all men. I want to say a word about the gender imbalance in our presentations. The hermits we've visited all wrote about their experience. And it is through their writings that we've come to know them. None of them are women, and there are many causes and conditions behind this, some of which might be literacy, mobility, autonomy, economic means, so many factors, right? So I want to do a little more research about this. I'm thinking maybe even this Wednesday night I might introduce a few Chinese and Japanese women who I think could have qualified as persons in the hut. But I also want to read about other women, both Buddhist women and writers, who have lived for long periods in solitude. So stay tuned. But I'm the one who chose Thoreau and Thomas Merton, two modern-day writers who have become famous as hermits, who never really were hermits. I wasn't sure why I wanted to include them, other than because I wanted to read their work. I knew I wasn't familiar enough with them. And I have a better idea now why it's important to look at their experience, so I hope that'll become clear as we go along. For those of you who might have missed my talk on Henry David Thoreau, it's posted online, and it was really revealing for me to read more of him and realize how little time he spent in his famous cabin on Walden Pond, scarcely over 2 years, and how involved with his family he still was during that time. So he was both a hermit and very much still connected to the world. So if I thought I was biting off more than I could chew with Thoreau, I really was with Merton. This guy was incredibly prolific. A couple of years ago, I started reading a critical biography of Merton called Heretic Blood, The Spiritual Geography of Thomas Merton. And it was really interesting, but I got to, something like practice period started or something intervened so that I couldn't follow through. And I was thinking at the time that a series of, a Dharma seminar could be based on the different aspects of his life. The seeker, the Trappist monk, the hermit contemplative, the social critic and activist, the lover. The poet, writer, the wise teacher. He had so many different facets. He was a complicated character, as was Thoreau. In keeping with our theme, though, I want to keep the focus mostly on his life as a hermit and what it meant to him. But the challenge of looking at the person in the hut is that the whole person's life is present there in the hut. You may have noticed this anytime you go to Sesshin or take up a practice of solitude for a period of time. Your whole life is there, right with you, right? Sometimes in great detail. You sit down on your zafu and what happens, right? Worry about the future, replaying conversations, vivid memories from the distant past. What are you going to do with the rest of your life? All right there on your zafu, right? So you can bet that the hermits of yore had their own rough times on their zafus too. And that's why they relied on work, physical activity, and walking in the mountains and the forest, as well as sitting on their zafu. And it's because sometimes those moments of body and mind dropping away, you know, our defensive structures, occur more easily outside the hut, when we're least expecting them, when we're least straining after them. So let me try to give you some context for Thomas Merton as a person in the hut. I am in no way a Merton scholar, and I'm sure some of you may have read more of Merton than I have. I decided that rather than make an attempt on his voluminous output of writing, to limit myself to a wonderful compilation from his journals. It's called The Intimate Merton. Here it is, The Intimate Merton, His Life from His Journals. So it's a section spanning decades. Much of his writing during his life was published by Catholic publishers who actually exerted considerable power of censorship over his content, any content that was too controversial or unbecoming of a monk, and or unbecoming of his stature, as he became, you know, quite a charismatic and public figure, even though he was confined to his monastery most of the time. But these journals of his became a kind of lifelong practice, and they reveal a tension, an ongoing tension between the demands of his vocation and his commitment to the order and his calling and work as a writer and his yearning for solitude and contemplation. These three parts of his life, often in tension. When I read his journals, I came to realize, as I did with Thoreau, that he did not have as much time as a solitary hermit as his reputation would suggest or lead you to believe. Merton was born in 1915 in France. His father was a New Zealander pursuing a career in painting, and his mother was an American Quaker and also an artist. His early life is detailed in his first book, an autobiography called The Seven Story Mountain, which became an ongoing bestseller. I have not read it, but it's about how he came to his vocation through his youth and when he was a young man. His childhood and youth were marked by the death of his mother when he was 6, his father when he was almost 16. Leaving him in the guardianship of a family friend. Unlike Sawaki Kodom, whom Michael talked about last night, who was orphaned quite young, Merton's mother's family had the resources to ensure his education, but his life was clearly destabilized by these losses. He was moved from school to school. He traveled on his own in Europe. He spent a year at Cambridge, where he threw himself into what we might call wine, women, and jazz. He was known for that now somewhat outdated word, womanizing. So his guardian decided he would be better off in New York, of all places, where he attended Columbia University and thrived. But he also began there to explore Catholicism. He'd had some kind of mystical experiences already, and then he did, again, in New York, have some mystical experiences. And so, which led to this aspiration to become a monk, a Catholic, and join the Catholic Church. So he was confirmed in the Catholic Church in 1939. And that's where these journals pick up, is after he had set out on this path. So I'm just going to read you a series of passages from the journals and make some comments along the way. So this first excerpt is from 1939, soon after he entered the Catholic Church, but he's not a monk yet. "If I don't pretend like other people to understand the war," is 1939, "I do know this much, that the knowledge of what is going on only makes it seem desperately important to be voluntarily poor, to get rid of all possessions this instant. I am scared sometimes to own anything, even a name, let alone a coin or shares in oil, the munitions, the airplane factories. I am scared to take a proprietary interest in anything for fear that my love of what I own may be killing somebody somewhere." Still resonates, doesn't it? Here he's expressing this lifelong koan, so central to many of the hermits we visited and to many of us. How do you live a life of non-harming in a world of senseless greed, hatred, and ignorance? How do you do it? How not to be implicated in it all, when it is ultimately impossible not to be implicated in it all? It's impossible to be separated from the world of samsara as long as we live embodied human lives. How would he have understood the teaching that Michael talked about last night, the nirvana of no abiding? Remember that, those who were here? A bodhisattva does not abide in samsara nor in nirvana, not sticking, right? To inside or outside the hut, to relative or absolute. So Merton decided to enter the Trappist Monastery Gethsemane in Kentucky, now famous because of him and his reputation and writings. He was accepted as a novice in 1942, and 6 years later, this is what he wrote. "Maybe it will help me to do something about the distractions if I restrain my famished appetite for the things that distract me. New books about the order, my own work in print, etc. I don't expect to be without distractions. They are my cross. I suffer them with love in the sense that I am resigned to the drab business of remembering to sink below them when I can and keep with the God who holds my will in his darkness." Interesting, he's singing, sink below them rather than rise above. "I just have to love and love blindly and deepen the union that is there in spite of everything and not to break it up by fighting in the air." Interesting way of putting it, huh? So clearly his monastic life was not free of distractions. Nor is the Zen life, you know. For those of you who've maybe even spent time at Tassajara, it's still not free of distractions. Same year, this is 1948. "I have a terrific, undefined longing to give everything to God and a constant feeling that I am not doing so here. or not now. So he's this dissatisfaction that often comes up. To make a rule the whole meaning of my existence, and he's talking about the monastic rule, is not enough. To make an order, a spiritual tradition, the center of my life is not enough. Contemplation is not enough. By itself, it is not enough of an ideal. The complete gift of myself to Christ, transformation, total simplicity and poverty, these are some of the things I need. In other words, I need to get rid of everything. Here I am compelled to keep my hands full. And if I write, I am bound to live submerged in books. So this gives you the picture of his conflict. The monastic life at Gethsemane was actually quite busy, quite structured. They had a lot of enterprises, making cheese and kind of cottage industries. He didn't find that place of contemplation there. Plus, he had his writing habit. And that was an ongoing theme. It seemed that his writing was both a calling and a curse. He came to feel that this call of solitude was extremely elusive at the monastery. Last night, in my imperfection, I came out of meditation with a wild scheme of starting a sort of Carmelite desert out there. I know I'd never be allowed a one-man hermitage, but perhaps one might start a little house for special retreats where priors and guest masters and whatnot could escape for a little recollection, where one could go for a month at a time, or even more, and get in some real and solid contemplation. I can imagine no project less likely to meet with favor of our general chapter. That was the governing body. Such a notion has almost nothing to do with our order. For us, a retreat means only one thing, a more complete immersion in community. So maybe you hear some echoes of the voices of the hermits we've already visited, you know, who chose to step out of the monastic environment. Over and over in the journals, he chafes against the monastic restrictions, and then he reconciles himself again and comes to terms, makes his peace. How necessary it is for monks to work in the fields, in the rain, in the sun, in the mud, in the clay, in the wind. These are our spiritual directors and our novice masters. They form our contemplation. They instill virtue into us. They make us stable as the land we live in. You do not get that out of a typewriter or a laptop. So you can see how he appreciated work practice. And he also writes of Christian mysticism in a language that for me is kind of hard to grasp. It's a language of its own, almost. But I recognize something of the Dharma in this passage. Every Christian is, at the same time, a hermit and the whole church, and we are all members of one another. It remains for us to recognize the mystery that your heart is my hermitage, and the only way I can enter into the desert is by bearing your burden and leaving you my own. That's the practice of giving and receiving of Tonglen. He's, in other words. I'm going to say that last line again because I like it so much. It remains for us to recognize the mystery that your heart is my hermitage, and the only way I can enter into the desert is by bearing your burden and leaving you my own. So over the nearly 27 years that Merton spent at Gethsemane, he was incredibly prolific. He wrote over 30 books of essays, journals, poetry. And gradually he became less absorbed, self-absorbed, and more engaged with issues such as civil rights, the anti-nuclear, anti-war movements. He became a spokesperson, you know, from his monastery, a public figure. He became more ecumenical, and he explored his interest in Asian religions. He engaged in lively conversations with a wide variety of intellectuals, religious leaders, poets, voluminous correspondence, some of which have been collected in book form. And he was made novice master for a decade, from 1955 to 65, and he enjoyed teaching the young monks. This kind of was an engagement for him as well. But he continued to chafe against the rigidity of the monastic rule and the authority of the abbot. In 1958 now, so we're 10 years later, he wrote, "In the monastery, I have been forgetting how to think. And only in the past few days, I have woken up to the fact that this is very dangerous. I mean the constant habitual passivity we get into. No matter how honest the surroundings and how clean the doctrine believed in them, no man can afford to be passive and to restrict his thinking to a new rehearsal in his own mind of what is being repeated all around him. One must constantly be asking himself, what do I mean by this? Am I saying what I mean? Have I understood what this implies? Have I some notion of the consequences of what I'm saying?" And then a couple of months later, he writes this. It's a little list. A small monastery. 1. Without a program. 2. Without a special job to do. Monks to live, not to be monks, as distinct from every other kind of being, but to be men, sons of God. Change the gender. Work with the gender pronouns in your mind as we read. He was a man of his times. 3. Without a special future, no drive for postulance. 4. Without a special reputation or renown for anything. 5. A hidden monastery, not well known, perhaps as a monastery, perhaps not even wearing a special habit, without observably distinctive buildings. 6. Certainly isolated, cloistered and cut off. 7. With hermit types, i.e. possibilities for personal solitude for a certain portion of the year. Special solitude in certain seasons, Advent, Lent. 8. Made up of a nucleus of mature monks, each one able to decide for himself in fasting, etc. Notice how he wouldn't have to worry about the young ones anymore. 9. Taking an interest in art, music, literature, politics, etc. of our time. And 10. Manual labor, of course. Maybe some teaching. But care to keep the life from getting crowded with works and projects. Sounds like a pretty good little Zen monastery, doesn't it? So he conceives the idea of leaving Gethsemane to live in a kind of radical small monastery in Mexico with his friend Ernesto Cardenal. He says, "I have a koan to work on. Who is this that wants to go to Mexico?" And he kind of berates himself. "I have not tried hard enough to be content in community. In fact, I've almost refused to let myself be content, as if there were a danger in it, something to lose by it, as if by being content I would give in, lose my freedom, be trapped. But actually, there is all the difference in the world between contentment and acquiescence. Contentment is an interior thing that goes with freedom. Freedom depends on it, and he who cannot be content in adversity cannot be free. Contentment has nothing to do either with defeat or compromise. For when I am content, I recognize that I need no other conditions and no other situation in order to be free and happy. This is, in one sense, to transcend the whole business. So, he did not receive permission to go to Mexico, and he actually regrouped. You know, he swung back into this sense of contentment, working, being with what is. And here's the first time, at least in this book, that Zen appears. He says, "My Zen is the slow swinging tops of 16 pine trees. One long thin pole of a tree 50 feet high swings in a wider arc than all the others, and swings even when they are still. Hundreds of little elms springing up out of the dry ground under the pines. My watch among oak leaves, my t-shirt on the barbed wire fence. The wind sings in the bare wood." So something's shifting here. And still, he struggles with his desire to be recognized. Determined to write less, to gradually vanish, do not know how, and do not pretend it is easy, to vanish from popularity into insecurity and anguish by my own decision to be alone is perhaps dangerous and arbitrary, yet this must be done. I must begin to do what I must do, not insisting on it as a preference, which perhaps, after all, it really is not. So still he's yearning for solitude, yearning for solitude. I will stop making any kind of effort to justify myself to anybody, to prepare a place for myself anywhere, among any group. It is this that I have to face, this and the necessity to give up any activity that leaves the slightest intended impression upon the surface of the world. This and the necessity to renounce all surreptitious reaching for human immortality, for being remembered. The primary duty, to seek coherence, clarity, awareness, insofar as these are possible. Not only human coherence and clarity, but those that are born of silence, emptiness, and grace. Which means always seeking the right balance between study, work, meditation, responsibility to others, and solitude. That really caught my eye. Because I have this thing that I call Kate's Law of Thirds. Kate's Law of Thirds means one third of waking hours in quiet solitude, which could include reading or writing as well. One third outdoors, either working or in the forest, walking in the mountains. And one third in community and service. So I thought, oh yeah, same thing. And I, like Thomas Merton, I can really relate to this. I'm always having to rebalance. There's always one side that's overbalancing the others, and I have to kind of, oops. So maybe some of you can relate. I have been shocked at a notice of a new book by Rachel Carson on what is happening to birds as a result of the indiscriminate use of poisons, which do not manage to kill the insects they intend to kill. Someone will say, "You worry about birds, why not worry about people?" I worry about both birds and people. We are in the world and part of it, and we are destroying everything because we are destroying ourselves, spiritually, morally, and in every way. It is all part of the same sickness. It all hangs together. 1962. So in 1963, Merton finally received permission to spend time in a hermitage, built a short walk away, out of sight of the monastery, kind of up on a hillside looking over the forests and the fields. And at first he just spent short time, so he was allowed to go up there and, you know, read and meditate and write for a while. But he was still keeping most of the monastic schedule, coming down to teach his classes. And of course, he would also just work around fixing the place up and going for long rambling walks. Kind of reminds you of Thoreau. And Merton, too, is a detailed observer of nature. His writings on nature, there's a little book that's been recently compiled with excerpts from all his writings, just his writings on nature, and it's quite lovely. After a few years, he was allowed to spend longer periods and relieved of more of his duties, his teaching duties. And finally, he was allowed to stay overnight. This is a big thrill for him. Let me read you this. I am beginning to see that the question of solitude for me is finally getting to be no longer a question but of wish, but of decision. For the moment, it seems to involve also cutting off 100 contacts in the world and even legitimate and fruitful concerns with the events and needs of the time. I do not know or understand how far this needs to go, except that I am caught in all kinds of affairs that are no longer my business, and that they may prove to be great distractions and evasions, yet I do not yet see where to begin. It will also involve renouncing definitively some of the securities of the community. Sleeping here has been a great grace. Last night, full moon, at midnight, the whole valley was drenched in silence and dark clarity. Cold this morning, going down to the monastery in the dark, I could feel frost on the grass and the dry corn husks under my feet. The profoundest and happiest times in my life have been in and around Gethsemane, and also some of the most terrible. But mostly the happy moments were in the woods and fields, alone with the sky and sun, and up here at the Hermitage. One thing the Hermitage is making me see, that the universe is my home, and I am nothing if not part of it. In an age where there is much talk about being yourself, I reserve to myself the right to forget about being myself, since in any case there is very little chance of my being anybody else. Rather, it seems to me that when one is too intent on being himself, he runs the risk of impersonating a shadow. How much of the time are we impersonating a shadow? A kind of fantasy construct of who we are. You can kind of feel a sense of Zen practice, even though he wasn't explicitly doing Zen practice, starting to infuse his life. To be conscious of both extremes in my solitary life, consolation and desolation, understanding and obscurity, obedience and protest, freedom and imprisonment. He's starting to be able to hold these paradoxes of life on this earth, let alone monastic life. Once he gets some extended time on his own, he realizes the rigors and challenges of the solitary life, as well as the blessings. The solitary life, now I really confront it, is awesome, wonderful, and I see I have no strength of my own for it. Deep sense of my own poverty, and above all, awareness of the wrongs I have allowed in myself together with this good desire. This is all good. I am glad to be shocked by grace and to wake up in time to see the great seriousness of it. I have been merely playing at this, and the solitary life does not admit of mere play. Contrary to all that is said about it, I do not see how the really solitary life can tolerate illusion and self-deception. It seems to me that solitude rips off all the masks and all the disguises. It does not tolerate lies. Everything but straight and direct affirmation is marked and judged by the silence of the forest. Even if you go to Sesshin for a week, and I mean round-the-clock Sesshin, not what we're doing here, it becomes less and less possible. You can't do it if you keep hanging on. You know, you just have to let go because it's too exhausting otherwise. It works on you. The 5 days I have had in real solitude have been a revelation. So finally, for the first time, he's actually had 5 days straight of solitude after all this time. Whatever questions I may have had about it are answered. Over and over again, I see that this life is what I have always hoped it would be and always sought, a life of peace, silence, purpose, meaning. And yet he still feels he needs to go deeper into his meditation. He's drawn inexorably to the East and to Buddhist practice. By now he's met D.T. Suzuki, the great popularizer and interpreter of Zen to the West. In the last 2 years of Merton's life, I'm going to read you one more bit before this about this still wanting more. He says, my own personal task is not simply that of a poet and writer, still less commentator, pseudo-prophet. It is basically to praise God out of an inner center of silence, gratitude, and awareness. This can be realized in a life that apparently accomplishes nothing. You know, think of our earlier hermits who accomplished not much, right? And yet their lives had this quality, silence, gratitude, awareness. Without centering on accomplishment or non-accomplishment, my task is simply the breathing of this gratitude from day to day in simplicity. And for the rest, turning my hand to whatever comes, work being part of praise, whether splitting logs or writing poems, or best of all, simple notes. And then he adds, and there will remain occasional necessary letters. So during the last 2 years, that was 65, the last 2 years of Merton's life, 67, 68, just as I said those dates, I remember, you know, he comments also what happened during those times with the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. I just had a memory of my own, still in high school, memory of those times. But in those last 2 years, for Merton, two life-altering things happened. First, he fell in love with a young nurse whom he met when he was in hospital for back surgery. He was head over heels in love for about 3 months. And then he reined himself in, recalling the strength of his vows, and after a scolding from the abbot, who caught him making sneaky phone calls. Despite the 20-year age difference, there was a strong mutual attraction between this lovely young woman adoring the wise and famous older man, and the older man coming alive in the light of her care and adoration. But only a few months later, Merton would write of this experience and in a dismissive tone, dismissing it as silly. Unlike Ryokan, for those of you who remember Ryokan, and his relationship with the young nun, Teishin, which stayed strong. I mean, this was in his 70s, early 70s, but it stayed, and she was in her early 30s. It stayed strong until the end of his life. And was, to use the quaintly antiquated word, chaste. Merton's relationship was chaste only in the most technical sense. And he was ultimately unable to fully realize a relationship with a grown woman into the structure of his life and vows. Much more could be said about all that, but not now. Because the second and even more powerful life-altering event was Merton's trip to Asia. There was finally a new abbot who was more permissive and liberal, who allowed Merton to travel. And the plan was he would travel to India, Thailand, and Indonesia. He would give lectures and meet with various Buddhist leaders. He wrote in his journal, "May I not come back without having settled the great affair?" And found also the great compassion, Maha Karuna. "I am going home to the home where I have never been in this body." Now the writer who, a journalist, where I found this quote, had trouble with that phrase, the great affair. At first he thought, did it mean the love affair? And he said, no, that was over by then. And then he thought, it must be the great affair of the, you know, the East versus West in Merton's life, and he didn't realize that the great affair, the great matter in Zen, is life and death. He totally didn't know that. That's what I think the great that Merton's referring to. The details of more of his journey are more than we can include. Though a highlight was he had several interviews with lengthy interviews with the Dalai Lama, and they really hit it off, as you might imagine. But soon after that, in Bangkok, in a hotel in Bangkok, he was coming out of the shower, presumably slipped, grabbed a floor fan, and was electrocuted. The shockwaves of his death reached around the world. Some writers on Merton have expressed theories that his time on earth or his mission was complete. You know how we like to have comforting explanations for sudden, seemingly meaningless deaths. But yet his journals reveal a continued searching. He was considering upon return. He knew his place was not in Asia. And in that tradition, although it meant so much to him, he was considering returning, but not to Gethsemane. He was considering going to Alaska or to a place on the coast of California where he would be more remote in a smaller, simpler community, that dream of this, of a small community. Kind of, he would be halfway between Asia and his old life had he done so. Who knows? We can never know how he would have continued to evolve in his practice of being a hermit in the world. I like to imagine how he might have appreciated Dogen Zen if he could have become acquainted with it. There's scarcely anything translated at that time. Maybe some of Merton's life koans have resonated with you as they have with me. As with Thoreau, the complexities and contradictions of this man bring him closer to us, I think, as we take them maybe off their pedestals. They both struggled to find a way of living simply and ethically in a world that values acquisitive consumerism and also to live with the social injustice that entails. And at the same time, they sought the quiet of retreat from that world to experience directly a dissolving of the boundaries between self and world. Thinking back on the hermits we visited on our time traveling over the past week, over more than 1,500 years, the common themes are quite remarkable. They lived often in times of hardship and social chaos, instability, not all, but often. And they lived lives of simplicity, contemplation, work, manual labor, reading, writing. Kamono Chome played his biwa. Oh, I left out intimacy with the natural world. Very, very strong in all of them. Kamono Chome played his biwa. Ryokan gave away his calligraphy. Thoreau grew his melons and gave them away. Homeless Kodo traveled Japan, hermit without a hut, and offered his teaching of Zazen widely outside the monastery. Thomas Merton gave his writing to the world. And Churto, our very first hermit, left us this song that we've been chanting every morning, Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. So as we close our time together, I'd like to ask you, and myself, what will flow out to the world from your grass roof hut? Your grass roof hermitage. So, thank you so much for joining us in this strange way. First sesshin we've tried to do in this session. We've done weekends, but this is the first longer. So thank you for listening to our talks and showing up in the morning and for practicing in whatever way you have to keep that continuity of sesshin mind going through the day. And maybe that's something we can take forward. How to do that. Yeah. So, thank you, and let's chant. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.